Before we get started, I want to tell you why I keep urging you to use KISS Insights. Haven't you noticed that one of the big ideas that keeps coming up in my interviews is the need to ask your customers and users what they want instead of imagining that you know? Now, when you add a survey to your website, isn't it true that hardly anyone fills out your survey, and people who do fill it out aren't necessarily your typical users? Well, what KISS Insights does is give you surveys that are so easy to fill out that your users will actually complete them. Here's a screenshot of how I use KISS Insights. You can use it for free right now. Just go to kissinsights.com. Next thing I want to show you is the phone number at the top of dnamail.com. When you have trouble with your email and it's costing your business both money and reputation, how frustrating is it? Well, who can you call at those moments? If you use DNA Mail, you'll have a phone number you can call 24/7. DNA Mail offers complete hosted exchange, free setup, free activation, free support, and if you and your company need Google Apps, they've got you covered there too. DNAMail.com. These aren't just sponsorships, these are tools you should use. Finally, I want you to know about Shopify.com. If you already have an online store and want to increase your sales, go to Shopify.com. If you have an idea for an online store, go to Shopify.com. With Shopify, they'll set up your store in minutes. You'll get professional themes to customize your store. You'll even get a mobile app to manage your store from anywhere. Check out Shopify.com. Here's the program. Hey everyone, it's Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. You guys know we do here every weekday. I bring a new entrepreneur on who's built a successful business to come and talk about how he built that business, what he learned along the way, and more importantly, to help my audience go out there and build their incredible businesses so at some point in the future I can interview them. Today, to help learn, to help show us how he built his business, I invited Ricard Shellberg, who founded Ellipsis Systems back in 1999 and sold his company 3 years later to OpenWave Systems. Today, he's the co-founder of Ingbu, which aims to bring blogs, news, and deals to web users in a clutter-free place. My goal with this interview is to find out how he launched and grew Ellipsis, and also to find out what he's done with his current company with Ingbu. Ricard, welcome to Mixergy.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
So let's start with Ellipsis. What was that company?
Ellipsis was a mobile internet startup in 1999, and we started in Stockholm, Sweden, which was really kind of the hub for mobile at the time. And obviously a lot of the things that we thought were going to happen are happening now, 10, 11 years later. But it was exciting times. And so we ended up building one of the first mobile app stores for deployment with wireless service providers.
So first mobile app, it looks like the live audience is telling me that they can't watch us. I'm going to hit a button for them. We're dealing with a few technical issues today, but I think we've got most of them solved by now.
Good.
So what was in the app store back then?
Well, back then, actually, mobile app store was actually a combination of things, especially in Europe. You would actually go to a physical store, buy a magazine, open up the centerfold, and see a bunch of short codes, punch in one short code, and before you know it, you'll get a premium SMS with a ringtone. And today, it's obvious that you use your browser or some shopping client on your phone, etc. But we actually worked with Siemens and Sony Ericsson and other mobile device providers or manufacturers to integrate browsers with the content environment. It could be a Java execution environment or the ringtone manager, whatever, in the phone, so that we could create a shopping experience on the phone, actually. And this was, you know, groundbreaking in 1999. Unfortunately, in Europe, the model remained kind of, you know, buy a ringtone with an SMS. And so we found our market in the US, actually, and did a Delaware corporation and set up an office in Dallas, Texas, because our CEO that we recruited lived there. And before we knew it, we were working with one of the larger wireless service providers, Sprint.
Okay, let's take this step by step to understand
sure.
it. So before you got in this business, people were actually going to centerfolds in magazine, not to see women, but to see short codes. typing there those short codes into their phones, then they'd get the app delivered to their phone remotely. People actually did this?
Yes. Well, it sounds like it's ages ago, but it's actually, you know, about 10 years ago. And so, yeah, that's how it was done. Yeah.
Ringtones. And what kind of apps did they get at the time?
It was just ringtones. Started with monophonic ringtones, you know, do-do-do-do-do-do. And then polyphonic was the big thing. And, yeah, and then, of course, with Sun Microsystems starting to work really hard on Java 2 Micro Edition, J2ME, it became more and more interesting to be able to download applications to your phone. And actually, the fact that Sun was working on this in parallel with our efforts created a fantastic opportunity for us. We ended up partnering with Sun, actually.
Okay. All right, so you see this. What's the vision for the business that you have? What do you envision launching?
Well, at the time, we were envisioning launching a an internet experience for mobile phones that was truly mobile, wireless, consumer-friendly, if you want, and turn the phone into a marketplace. That's really what we wanted to do.
A marketplace for what? What were you thinking people would buy?
Anything that you could consume on the phone. And it's funny you mentioned this because some of the conversations we had with unnamed characters, you know, they thought, you know, that we were kind of looking at it as a vending machine for physical goods. But we were very much focused on anything that could be consumed on the device. So ringtone, obviously, wallpaper, change the background on the phone. You know, and then obviously games and, you know, later on video, etc., right? That was the idea. We thought that those things had value and people would be willing to pay for it because a phone is a very individual, personal device. And if I can make it more personal, I will and I'll pay for it. And I think the ringtone market in Europe proved that that was indeed the case. And we thought you could replicate that with other content, like Java games, for example.
And how would you get your store, your marketplace, onto people's phones?
Yeah,
what did
so
you
what
imagine
we ended up,
you would do?
Yeah, what we did, what we ended up doing was focusing on the wireless service providers. And initially, I think that was the right strategy. But as soon as these app stores were getting deployed with the wireless service providers, you start to realize that they are not really good at merchandising goods. So later, you know, in early 2000, between 2000 and 2005, you saw the emergence of services like Motor City is an example. They're running a lot of mobile content stores for carrier service providers today, AT&T being one, I believe. And so it was better for the service provider to actually partner with someone who understood marketing and content merchandising recommendations, etc., and can run it as a business. And they it kind of morphed into revenue share models instead. But we were actually deploying a product, which was the platform on which you would build your branded mobile app store, basically. And but the business model would have been better if we had offered it as a service.
How do you mean? What's the difference between offering the platform and offering the service?
Well, I mean, one thing you have to also think about here is we got acquired by OpenWave Systems, and OpenWave Systems is in the products business, infrastructure business. So in that business, you would build a product which you would deploy on servers that you may or may not own, but then you would sell that product to the to a customer who would own it and manage it themselves and do whatever they want to do with it themselves. That is very different from striking a deal with a service provider saying, hey, we can provide this value-added service to your customers, the end users, and you don't really have to pay anything up front for this, but as we sell goods to your customers, we're going to make money and we're going to share that with you, so we'll write you a check. That's the difference. So instead, you know, you would basically operate the whole thing, and there's only one product, which is what you're running, and you have branded experiences with your partners, the service providers. Yeah.
I see. And why is it better the other way? Why is it better to just hand it over to them and just sell them, I guess, a license?
Well, I mean, in this case, with mobile app stores, it is not better. It's better to run it as a service because your customer partner here, let's say a Sprint or a Verizon or an AT&T, will actually end up making more money if they partner with a company that is really focused on the whole, having the store online, merchandising goods, promoting new content, making sure that there's relevant content tied to current events available, et cetera, right? So that drives revenue, and more so than, I mean, some software should be sold as products, mobile access gateways, sure. Messaging gateways like an SMSC. But this is an end user focused service, and partnering would be better. And as it turns out, that's how it's done today, mostly.
I see. Okay, I misunderstood. I thought you did partner with them, and you're saying that's the way you should have done it.
That's how we should have done
I
it. We
see.
licensed the product to them.
What in your
But
background led to this? I was looking at your LinkedIn profile and saw a Swedish Space Corporation. You were software manager there. You were CTO of Saab Transporter Tech. What about your background said, I love ringtones. I'm going to get into the wallpaper of iPhone or cell phone business.
yeah. Well, sometimes I call myself a rocket scientist, having worked at the Swedish Space Corporation, and indeed, we did build rockets and satellites there. However, I was part of a small group who was developing a mobile wireless location solution for the aviation and maritime industries, based on an invention by a Swedish inventor by the name of Håkan Lans. Håkan Lans is actually credited to be the inventor of color graphics. He has the patent for that and has been in litigations for years and years with a lot of developers of color graphics screens and et cetera, and the boards and whatnot. But he invented a communication scheme that was completely autonomous and allowed two vehicles, if you want, or two mobile units to communicate with each other and exchanging information without need for any base stations. So it works really well anywhere on planet Earth. And so I spent almost 5 years working on this solution, and I basically saw the emergence of mobile technology through this effort. And of course, in parallel, working closely with a lot of Swedish industry, you got Ericsson right next door, you have Nokia across the pond, and a lot of mobile technology was starting to integrate GPS. And which was what we were basing our solution on in a lot of cases. So I started getting interested in more consumer-oriented applications for mobile technology, actually. And so actually, the thing that really triggered me was wasn't so much building the mobile app store as, hey, I want to download really cool apps to my phone and turn them into things. Other than just making a call on, you can download an app that can make use of the technology on the phone, and you can turn it into a gaming device or a way to exchange position with your friends. Or I mean, the possibilities were infinite
So a
and
lot of
still
what
are.
we're seeing today with the iPhone and Android, that's what you were envisioning even back then.
Yes, in fact, we were envisioning exactly that. Then there was a time when I didn't believe in downloadable apps, and actually that belief stuck with me until the day Apple opened up the iPhone for developers, and then I came back and said, you know what, this is here to stay now, because I it wasn't really happening, it wasn't really taking off. Sun wasn't truly successful with Java on the phone. Qualcomm was trying something called Brew, binary runtime environment for wireless. Brew and Java, they're all competing. So I think it was a kind of a gimmick, but it wasn't really taking off. And but of course, what they all failed to realize was you have to have the right device. And I think Apple, cracked that nut. basically.
And the ease of use. I used to have a Trio for a long time, and I would add incredible apps to that thing. The thing is yeah. that if you tried to teach someone else how to add an app to it, or even how to add music to the Trio, you'd get lost and frustrated just trying to teach them, let alone yes. leave it to them to try to figure out how to do all that for themselves. They never would. I would see my friends carrying around these Trios, and I knew how yeah. powerful the Trio was. I would connect it to my computer and use the internet off of my Trio through tethering. I would do all kinds of great stuff with it. I would watch movies on it. And I would watch yeah. my friends do nothing but make phone calls and text because it had the yeah. keyboard. And I get so frustrated.
Yeah.
But
I mean, I think you belong to an exclusive group called the early adopter.
Called the nerds. The big freaking nerds.
You know, early adopters is a good term. And I think iPhone made the smartphone a mainstream device.
Yeah.
You know, that's the big difference here. Made it accessible.
Okay, so the other thing that's not screaming out of your background is entrepreneur. Were you entrepreneurial before launching this business?
Well, I started my first little business when I was 17. Now I'm gonna confess how old I am. But when I was 17. Basically, that's the era of the IBM PC, and I was obviously living in Sweden at the time, and there was literally no one who understood the PC platform, and I just learned a lot about software at the time, and I was also, you know, kind of a self-taught programmer, if you want, and there were a lot of issues around the PC, connecting it to printers that didn't work, or connecting it with different peripherals that needed drivers and software, etc. So I really started at that time, you know, as a software consultant, and did that off and on for several years. But then you're right, I worked for other people who were innovators and the creators of business. But I learned a lot from that as well. And in that sort of technical profession, you have to be entrepreneurial by nature in order to make things work as well. But then, you know, 1999 is when I truly did my first you know, larger scale startup. We took in funding. We were 38 people at the peak, basically, and we went after some big business, and we got acquired. Yeah, that didn't happen with my consulting business at 17.
Can you describe what it was like to take the leap from having a good job with it's a company that was spun off of Swedish Space Corporation?
Yeah.
So a dependable company, good job. You then leave that to go start your own business. What was that leap like?
It wasn't as dramatic as a lot of people think, and I think that has more to do with how you think about risk, and also how you what kind of heart you put into your work. So I spent, I mean, anywhere I ever worked, I've always given it, you know, 110%, and I got to a point at that time, the spin-off had gotten acquired by Saab, and we were a subsidiary of Saab, and I was the CTO there. I'd gotten to a point where, you know, the innovation—I had put a lot of innovative thought into you know, making this a product and taking it to market, which we did. But I also put in a lot of energy and heart into this thing. And I just woke up one day and I said, you know, there are all these things happening around me. I don't mind putting all this energy into work, but I should probably do it for myself for a while and see where that takes me. And it wasn't a revolutionary thought. It wasn't like, you know, it wasn't a dramatic move. It just started a process. And after about 6 months, I had been able to fool a friend of mine to become partner, really good, Martin Bergjung, who is a terrific software architect. And I had been able to get the support of an angel investor. And with a little over, I think we had $50,000, $40,000 in seed funding, in angel funding, we resigned from our jobs.
So you waited until after you got the funding to resign.
Yes, I mean, we did this kind of on the side, and got this angel funding committed.
How much did you build on the side before you got your funding?
Nothing. We had vaporware.
Slideware. Just a vision.
A vision and the PowerPoint. Yeah.
And did the vision include a business model? Did you say this is where our customers are going to come from, and this is where our revenue is going to come from?
No, we had ideas. We had ideas, and we had conviction. Of course, none of those ideas materialized the way we thought. But that's just the nature of doing startups. I mean, the idea. Someone said, you know, doing a startup is you got to run like crazy and then change direction. You know, and so I think a 180 is a dangerous thing. I think course corrections along the way are just necessary part of doing a startup, and if you're not willing to do them, you shouldn't be doing a startup.
So tell me about that. What did you think the direction was going to be, and then what did you have to change into?
Well, I mean, when we started Ellipsis, we believed that a lot of our business would be enterprise, as an example. We believed that a lot of enterprises would be building mobile apps, mobile workforce type applications. They will need, app stores, maybe they need a system that would make it very easy to access for the employee and to download the apps, you know, and then manage all that. So that's we thought that's where we would find our business, and you know, boy, we were wrong, you know.
Can you tell me how you figured out you were wrong? I'm curious to see how those adjustments happen as you build a company.
Well, I mean, there was obviously there was a lot of hype around mobile, first of all, and the hype was justified because if you look at the enterprise as an example, a larger portion of the workforce is mobile. Not only are they working remotely, but they're also mobile in their daily activities, and there were so many ideas of applications that should help any enterprise optimize their business. So there, you know, the opportunity was there. Now, I would say that the devices that came out didn't support these apps. Even though, for example, Motorola made a huge mistake of when they launched their first device that had an OpenWay browser on it and Java on it. They took an existing phone, I can't remember the model right now, took the existing phone, changed nothing but the software inside the phone, and they relaunched that. And people look at that thing and going like, okay, what's different? You know, there was nothing, there were no apps on it, that the form factor was the same. I mean, mistake after mistake like that was being done, and we failed to initially see that quickly. I mean, there was another company that launched in our category, also with the support of Sun Microsystems, called Jamdat. They very quickly realized that the apps are going to be the opportunity is actually going to be in building the apps themselves, not the platform. We built the platform, right? And so Jamdat, they started to build games, and even though Sun invested in them, they said, forget that, we're gonna go with Qualcomm and Brew, and actually they went IPO, and then they got acquired by Electronic Arts, possibly. And they did, so they changed faster than we did, basically. But you know,
when did you realize that you needed to change?
We needed to realize that, first of all, our market would not be in Europe, given the as soon as we realized that this is a consumer-facing play, we had to go look at a market that would use our model for engaging with mobile content, i.e. through the browser, downloading through the browser, and then launch it. I mean, it sounds obvious, but it wasn't at the time. So the U.S. market was the right market for
Can you help me understand or Take me through to the time when you realized it, because a lot of times when you're in business and you're heading in one direction, it's hard to notice anything in any other direction. And if things aren't working out, you sometimes say, especially if you have a partner, you cheer each other on and you keep each other going in the same direction. So the fact that you even realized it, whether it happened late or early or just on time perfect, isn't as important as how did you realize it, so that the rest of us, when we go through our situation where we're going in the wrong direction, might look back and say, ah, Ricard, he experienced something similar. He adjusted. Let's stop for a second and reconsider. Yeah. So what was it like for you?
I mean, first of all, don't ignore the data. Okay, there's no, you cannot justify something and or sort of discount the data. So in this particular case, fortunately for us, we were still in Sweden, in Stockholm at the time, and Sun Microsystems had decided to put their mobile business unit in Stockholm because Ericsson and Nokia and all these companies were there, and we ended up working with them, and they opened a lot of doors for us with wireless service providers all over in Europe, and we weren't really getting anywhere. And then, you know, we started to talk to some carriers in the US, and in the US, not only were they willing to work with a little startup, but they, you know, they were looking at the same model. And when you sit down and just look at your, you know, look at your track record, you're seeing, you know, the tractions in the US. We need to move over there.
I see. And what got you started looking at the US in the first place?
Well, it was actually primarily through this partnership, which is the other thing that's really important. The right kind of partnerships for a startup are just absolutely crucial. And the right startup is defined by what it isn't, okay? A partnership with another dinky little startup like yourself is going to go nowhere, okay? So that what you need is a partnership with a solid, large a corporation who is willing to champion your technology and, you know, be your chaperone and support you. And that can be through personal relationships or just a great technology fit. The reasons are many, okay? But so we had been able to partner up with Sun Microsystems. Now, we weren't the only company that they partnered with, but they were very supportive of us. And so they said, you know what, we're talking to Verizon, well, not so much Verizon, but we're talking to AT&T, we're talking to Sprint, they're getting interested in this whole mobile Java idea, they want to talk to some companies, come on over. And so we said, well, come over. So we went over, yeah, and that's how it started.
I see, okay, and then they, all right, and they introduced you. Let's go back then to funding, speaking of introductions.
Yes.
Who was the angel? And how did you meet him?
The angel is a is Leif Medin, who's a very successful entrepreneur in Europe. He has had several businesses, but the thing that kind of provided him the opportunity to do angel investments was actually to develop a PC distribution chain in the former Eastern European bloc, starting with Poland. There was no infrastructure in place there, and he saw the opportunity, went down there and did it. He's Swedish, by the way. I've known him since I was 17, and I had my little consulting business.
How did you meet him at 17 as a consultant?
We did business with the largest PC distributor in Sweden at the time. He was in the education space, teaching employees at different companies to how to use a computer, and I was working for this distributor doing fixing things, basically.
I see.
And that's where we met. So, and we've stayed in touch
through
the years.
How did you stay in touch? A lot of times people meet great contacts like that, and they'll lose touch, or they'll work hard to stay in touch. But basically what, as Heidi Roizen said here when I did an interview with her, they end up being pen pals, which isn't a useful relationship. How did you make that relationship last?
Well, first of all, you know, it's okay if it takes, if there's a few years between staying in touch at times, but it's good if you're, you know, moving in this same circles or similar circles, and you're inevitably going to bump into each other. And in this particular case with Leif, I would say that the fact that we have the same interests outside of business was very helpful.
Like what? What were the interests?
He's an avid windsurfer, and so am I. So that helped a lot.
I see. So you'd go windsurfing with him.
Yeah, we would go windsurfing together, or we would bump into each other windsurfing. I mean, not physically, but yeah, we would bump in. We would be at the same place and go to the same events and stuff. And so that was always a lot of fun. And I always took a big interest in what he was doing, and he did the same with me. So that's how it was.
See, yeah. That's interesting, because a lot of people would say when they're doing their hobbies, when they're out there being active, they don't want to see people from work. They don't want to talk work with anyone. How much work was going on? How much of it felt like you were bringing the office into your hobby?
Well, I mean, if you're taking an interest in someone's life, it's bound to be about work too, at least 50%. And so, I mean, this was not, you know, sitting down discussing, you know, business deals or opportunities or stuff like that. This was about, you know, taking interest in the lives of each other, you know, and that's I think that's different, even though a lot of that is work related. You're right.
All right. I also don't see in your background sales, that you were a salesman at any point. What was it like to sell someone on giving you, I think you said $50,000 or 40, what was it?
We started with 40. We ended up raising $7 million for Ellipsis.
So what was it like getting that first $40,000 from Leif?
We were, this is the other kind of really interesting thing. And I don't know if I'm, I think this is pretty common though. I mean, with Leif, we were excited, obviously, because he was pretty quick. We were talking to him for a couple of months, and then he said, okay, guys, I mean, let's do this. Okay, so that was exciting. But from that point on, anybody who does sales will tell you that, you know, it's a process. And when you get to the end of that process and when you do the deal, if you're not in that business, you would think, oh, that must be like winning the lottery. It isn't. It's anything but. It's a long, tedious process, and maybe it's a sigh of relief, you know, but the excitement isn't really there. So you have to learn to be excited about the process, you know. So I can't say that we were, you know, opening up the champagne and celebrating all night, you know, the Swedish way or anything. It was, you know, sigh of relief.
What is the Swedish way to celebrate all night?
Get really hammered, I would say, you know. Yeah, I'm too old for that.
Just like the American way.
Well, yeah, maybe, yeah.
Okay, so you get that. Actually, let's talk about your age. I have a note here to come back and ask you about that, since you said that you're aging yourself. How old were you when you started that company?
Ellipsis.
Yes.
Yeah, so Ellipsis was 1999. I was 34 years old. Yeah.
Okay, I had a guess here at 37, 34 years old. The reason I ask is a lot of times people assume that you've got to be in your early 20s or late teens in order to start a business, and any time after that, it's just impossible because you have obligations, because you're stuck in your rut. And frankly, I used to believe that too. I want to just keep highlighting the situations that don't fit that that stereotype. So what was it like for you later on to do it, later on in life? Not that 37 is that old, but...
Right, it's 34, by the way.
I'm sorry, 34. I'm thinking my guess was 37,
I'm
real particular. My own guess.
Yeah, I'm
superimposing my answer. Sorry.
No problem. Well, first of all, when I started Ellipsis, I still didn't have any kids. So I wasn't single. Actually, I got married that year, so we got married, started the company. But I would say this: anytime you decide to start a new business, it has its pros and cons. If you're like a PhD or you're working on your master's in the at the university and you're in your early 20s. You have certain, you know, assets, you know, like a stamina that is incredible, probably, and no distractions, you know, maybe nagging girlfriend or something, but other than that, no issues, right? But you you lack experience, and you make up with that. You make up for that by being, you know, maybe being arrogant, or but actually it's ignorant, right? So actually ignorance can be an asset if it's properly applied. But during that time it is. So the thing is, you become more effective as you get older, and you can manage multiple things, and you have more relationships, you have a bigger network, so you can get more stuff done with a more reasonable effort. And I wouldn't say that there's a golden, or sort of an ideal age for a startup. I mean, there's plenty of examples of people being, you know, well into their 50s. I think there was an article on CNN.com not too long ago about that. They listed a whole bunch of people that we all know. And unfortunately, I don't remember the name of anyone right now. But anyway, it's a good article. You're going to have all kinds of issues, but different issues no matter when you do it.
All right, you ran the company from 1999 to 2002. That just is straddling that toughest period of the internet. What happened? How did that affect you?
Well, we were a little bit shielded from this for two reasons. First of all, we started in Stockholm, and we were there for the first year and a half. And there was a little lag, and of course you were buffered, a little bit from this in Sweden. It would have been more difficult in Silicon Valley at the time, I think. However, because we also were focused on mobile more so than internet exclusively, we got a little bit of a break as well. But I would say that there was plenty of venture capital that dried up and wasn't available to us at the time. So that was, and I also think that we got acquired earlier than we otherwise would have because of that.
Because you needed to give your investors the return.
Partly that, but also, what actually happened was we had actually closed a B round $5 million or so, which it basically just lacked the signature. That week when we were reviewing that contract and closing on that, we were approached by OpenWave Systems, and we were we didn't have the muscle, if you want, to compete effectively at that time. So we said, okay, here's a fairly big company moving into our space, with us or without us. And so do we jump to their ship, or do we jump into the water and try to swim on our own? And so I think we realized that this is a good exit for everybody. And I believe that for our investors at the time, it was their best deal in 2002. A lot of the deal. So and you know, for me, I mean I was very excited to go work for OpenWave. I thought it was fantastic, and it gave me an opportunity to come back to the US and work here again, and I'm still here.
You ended up working for them for 3 years, but let's go back to when the deal closed. Was that an exciting moment? Did it feel sad because you sold too soon? What did it feel like?
It was an exciting moment, but also it was frustrating because a lot of the people from Ellipsis ended up having to be laid off, and that was a slow realization. Actually, we didn't believe that would happen at the time, but unfortunately, that was part of it. So it wasn't all great, but I believe that the people that worked at Ellipsis got some terrific experience, and we provided job opportunity for 3 years to people both in Sweden and the US. And I'm hoping that, I believe that a lot of these people took this experience and made other good things out of it. But it wasn't fun. It was a tough period. But also, it was also fun to being able to get a return for our investors and other shareholders.
What share of the company did you own at the sale?
At the sale, I owned about 8% of the company.
Okay. And the business was sold for $17.5 million in cash and stock?
It was roughly at 20, if you 19, 20 at total cash and stock. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. And you had 8% of that. Can we
Yes.
do the math on that and kind of figure out
You can
what?
do the math as
Okay.
much as you want.
No, we don't need to do it together. I don't want to get that detailed. I just want to get a sense of what happened
Let me put
after.
it. It allowed me to invest in a couple of houses and to save some money for my next startup.
I see. Okay. All right. How did those investments turn out for you?
Well, I'm still living in one of them, and the other one we're traveling to in the end of the month.
Oh, so you
So
still have them. You haven't sold them, you haven't flipped them or anything.
yeah, that's why I'm reluctant to call them investments. They're life investments.
I've seen people who ended up doing better with their real estate that they bought after they sold their business than they did with the business or anything afterwards.
That can happen, but yeah, we'll see. I'm hoping that these places will stay in the family for a long time.
Where are you, by the way? Where in the world today?
I'm in Santa Cruz, California.
Okay.
It's a small enclave here on the coast.
And you still have a place in Sweden? Is that where the other place is?
We bought a little summer house on the north tip of one of the popular islands for a summer vacation. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. And incidentally, it's the area where we had our wedding reception when I got married, too. So,
When'd you get
a lot
married?
of. When? 1999, same year as I started my first company,
I see.
actually.
So you went back to where you got married and you bought a place there. I see. Cool. Still
So,
married?
oh yeah, absolutely,
Okay. All right. I was a little
my
afraid to
wife,
ask
my
that
wife, my
question.
wife is, yeah, my wife is my biggest investor in me.
And what did you have kids now? I think you said.
Yes,
You
we have
do.
kids.
At what point did you have kids?
So the first, my first kid was born the year I started Ellipsis in 1999. So he's 10 years old now. And the second kid was born a year before we got acquired, 2 years later. So she's eight. And then we had a little straddler show up here 3 years ago as well. So I got three kids. Keeps us really busy on weekends and evenings. And my wife is working part time, so she's taking care of a lot of that, fortunately for me. But it's a lot of fun.
What was it like though? It's also very demanding. What was it like to have your first child just as you're building your business, just as you're getting ready to take off?
It was tough, especially for her, I believe. I think men are a little bit, when the kids are 1, 2 years old, it's more fun when they can walk and you can run around with them. So for me it was okay, but for her, I mean, I had some extreme, like 200 travel days during the first year, and so I was largely absent. But she's my you gotta have a good partner. That's the key thing here, and I have a good partner. She's very resilient and positive, a positive person. So it's key.
Do you have
You
any
gotta pick
advice
your part.
for?
You gotta pick. You gotta pick your partner even in private
No
life.
kidding. That's the most important partner you're ever going to get. Because that's a
Yes.
partner for life, whether it turns out good or bad.
Yes. Exactly. So it's as important in business as in life.
Yeah.
Privately.
Do you have any advice for somebody who has a child soon after launching a business? What did you learn the first time around?
Well, what I learned, it was really how important your spouse is, and to managing the stress. I mean, the amount of stress a couple can generate from sheer friction is incredible. And there's so much stress that you really don't need. There's so many issues and problems that you really don't have time for and shouldn't be worried about. And if you can find that in your relationship, I think, I mean, find that sort of zen of life, where you learn to just, focus on the important issues, then I think you can get a lot of stuff done. So
All right, how do you go after running your own company after being the captain, how do you end up working for two different businesses over 6 years? What was that like?
Well, I mean, if you look at it at OpenWave, I ended up being the captain, you know, like one of the little emperors over there, over
Right.
a couple of
I see.
product units. You know, we and actually those product units were twice the size of Ellipsis, so it was certainly was like running a business within the business. But of course, I learned a lot about kind of corporate politics as well, and I think I learned fairly quickly how to navigate that as well. So that was the added sort of dimension. But it was really like running a business, both at OpenWave and then Venturi Wireless, where you know I was the product manager there as well. And it's again, you have profit loss responsibility. You got to take a product to market. You got to make sure it's doing the right thing at the right price, etc. So I mean, it wasn't different. It was just that your ownership is different. You know, you own less.
You know, can I just say I noticed a mistake that I made as an interviewer. As I asked that question, I noticed that I was making a face and also acting like, how do you go from being a free man to being in jail? Which is just no way to do an interview. What I really need to find out is what it was really like, not how bad must it have been. Not impose my own expectations on the situation. So let me ask the reverse of that. What was good about that? What did you notice about working somewhere else, going back to having a job that actually was better, that was reassuring, let's just say better instead of adding in.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, you work for a larger corporation, you will develop your personal network. You know, very, very quickly. And the people, and if you work for a company like OpenWave Systems at the time, it was the best company to work for in terms of meeting great people, and who since then moved on and done great things. A lot, you know, several of my friends ended up going over to AdMob, and AdMob got acquired for over $700 million, was just approved. You know, other people gone to Google, Yahoo, you know, Microsoft via Danger Research, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And just great, great, great people that I'm still in touch with today, you know, and who are, you know, can be helpful in the future. And, you know, you help them, they help you, and you can't take any of that away from you. So that's helpful. And also, like I said, learning more about corporate politics is important. It's always going to be there, large or small. And in a large corporation, it's significantly more complicated usually. So navigating that is good. So I think it was, you know, very, very positive experience for me.
How does the stress level compare? In your case,
well, I mean, you're asking the wrong person, because I think that's part of being kind of a startup guy and entrepreneur. You there's the stress level will never go above here, you know. It doesn't matter. You know, there's the responsibilities are largely the same, except that I'm responsible to other people. I'm not responsible to the investors. Okay, I'm responsible to the CEO or the general manager for the infrastructure product unit or something. So there's a responsibility there, and that's no different. It's just that, you know, it's based on different aspects. So for me, it wasn't any different really. Difference. The difference, though, I mean, would say that, you know, with my most recent startup, the difference is financial. So with this startup, we really decided to put in our sweat equity, even though we with Ingbo we've raised $1 million in seed funding. We haven't taken any salary ourselves. A lot of people call themselves startup guys, and they're basically moving on, getting someone to invest, and then they give themselves a hefty salary, and if it doesn't work in 6 months, they're off to do something else. But we decide not to do that, and we had the luxury that we could afford to kind of invest our own into it, in you know, with the hope that we would keep more of the company also, at the end. So I mean, it's not a charity business for us, but you know, there were some ideas behind doing it that way. But that has been a big difference for the family. We have to be more careful with economy, and we've been at it for 2 years soon. So it's we'll see how it goes.
All right, you launched the business in 2008. What was the original vision?
The idea was, I mean, it was born out of frustration with daily life, actually, and trying to become more productive. Like most people, we have a hectic business life, and we have the family, as we discussed, with kids, etc. And I really needed to save time as opposed to waste time. So, and we were struggling. Both Ferkan and I were struggling with using the internet to be productive. And so the idea was to create a solution that would reduce the clutter on the internet to make sure that we can stay focused on what's relevant. So it turned into a syndication service that allows publishers to syndicate content in a high attention environment, and it allows the consumers to organize whatever they do on the web. We call them web activities, you know, and organize that in a way that they can pay attention at the right time to stuff that's important to them. And web activities would be looking for a job, looking for a good deal on a laptop, finding the right airfare to Sweden, and et cetera, and those are all activities that we do, and we do them repeatedly. So by automating that process and then organizing the results in a what we call a list, a subscription list, it's essentially organizing stuff in a task list, but making sure the task list is organized in the right order at all times for you. So.
So let's use the examples that you just gave. I am thinking of going back to the US in a couple of months. I'm now in Buenos Aires. I
Okay.
might do a search for airfare every day until I find a great rate. That would
Yes.
be an activity that would be on the site.
Yes.
If I were also looking for a job, I might look every single day instead of going out to other sites and getting distracted and doing the same search repetitively. I would just bring that search to my Ingbu page. And
Yes.
maybe a couple of other things like stories that I might read on a few websites that I'm into. And all that would be
Yes.
on the web page. And the idea is that I could then sort it based on high priority and low priority.
Actually, the system sorts it for you. The system has there's a built-in algorithm that we have patented that will organize all this stuff in a based on its age, how old it is, and how important it is, and how you are interacting with it. So it's a learning system also. So the idea is really not to require users to have to configure stuff, because when you do that, it won't be mass consumer or consumer friendly. It will be back to the early adopter.
I see.
The
So
guys liked it.
if I'm interacting with one activity often, like the job search every day, then the system says, ah, that's a high priority activity for him. He's going to it every day. Let's have that bubble to the top. If I'm subscribing to the Wall Street Journal, but I really don't read it every day, that would just get pushed down to the bottom.
Yeah, it trickles down to the bottom for you in your list, and then of course it'll expire, and then if there's new information, it may perk up towards the top again. So it's a fairly dynamic environment. And then we made this available now in popular destinations. I mean, you can consume this list in Facebook. You can consume it on mobile devices. You can consume it on a portal and via Twitter as well. So it's really about making sure that your activities are with you wherever you spend your time on the internet. So.
How are you getting users of the service, the consumers? How are you getting them on?
Yeah, so really we are for our partner we're partnering, so here it goes back to the partnerships. So we are partnering with publishers. For example, our biggest partner is technorati.com out of San Francisco. They use our service to provide a connected search function to their audience. You go to technorati.com and you got the search window there in front and center. I may be interested in iPhone 4o, right, or whatever. And so I put in iPhone, and then they list all the articles around that iPhone, and the user can now click a little button or function says connect with this search. and consequently that ends up in the user's list. And if there's a new article popping up related to that search, they will get notified, and they can go back and read the article.
Notified so, by email?
Email, tweet.
And then it brings them back to the article on Technorati or on...
Yes, it brings you back to the article in Technorati, but even the email is... you don't get an email for everything that changes. You get a digest. This is about reducing the information, right? Reducing the clutter. So it gives you digest. There may be updates from Technorati and your job search and that laptop you're looking for. So you get that digest in the morning once, and then you can, you know, review that, and you may be clicking on one of the topics, or you may be going and look at a whole list, etc. You can do
What's
all kinds.
What's the business relationship behind that? Do you pay Technorati to be able to serve that up, and then you earn advertising? Do they pay you for the technology?
No, so it's a rev share relationship based on contextual advertisement. So the updates that are being generated, we monetize those. And this opens up a new venue for monetization for a publisher. We call it preview monetization, if you want. And we monetize it even in Facebook. So
how do you monetize the updates? Ads within the stream or something
yeah,
else?
Yeah, so in different places, but in the stream, if we create a list of new search items from Technorati around the iPhone, for example, well, that user is obviously interested in consumer electronics, so we will match a suitable ad with that context, you know, someone selling iPhones, etc., and place that in that context. So that goes with the email if it's an email update. If the user goes to our portal, it'll show in the portal. And of course, if he looks at it in Facebook, the user will see that ad in Facebook too.
Yeah. All right, Mike B in the audience is asking, how did you get Technorati to pay attention? So how'd you make that relationship happen? I'll broaden it a little bit.
You know, this is, again, okay, so if you ask me about another publisher, how do you get Forbes to pay attention, for example,
okay.
I would
say... Are you working with Forbes? I didn't see their logo on your site.
Well, I can't talk about Forbes, unfortunately, but there was an offer on the table, but it would cost us too much to do. So get attention. Okay, money gets people's attention. So in the case of Forbes, money would have gotten their attention.
Do you pay up front?
Well, I mean, it depends on what the publisher's business model is. If publisher is kind of like a Forbes, a traditional old media kind of publisher, they're gonna hate me for saying this, but they are more driven by maybe their quarterly quota, and they want to get, you know, X million dollars in ad revenue, as opposed to looking at a strategic partnership where they can really monetize their content syndication over time in a rev share agreement, maybe. Even get a piece of equity in the company for doing it. I mean, all kinds of things, and they're just not interested. A Technorati, on the other hand, which is a new media type of company who are really looking to drive new business models on the internet, they understand the internet, etc. They are more interested in looking at new technology. In their case, it was also about timing. They were looking for a new syndication solution for their content, and they had decided that they did not want to do it themselves. So we ended up approaching them when we were at the Blog World Expo in Vegas in October. Go to conferences. Best place to meet potential partners. That's my recommendation. You can corner them. They will listen to you. They're there to talk to you. And don't forget to do the follow-up. But anyway, so we started there, and it was good timing for them, and it was good timing for us. But you have to have a value proposition that makes sense for the publisher.
All right. Finally, how can people check this out? Should they go to your website, to ingbu.com, to experience the product? Should they do something else?
If you're a consumer, you can go to ingbu.com and look for the consumer button down to the right.
It's right on the bottom of the page.
To the right, yeah.
To the right.
Or you can go directly to ingbu.com/PVM, Papa Victor Mike, /portal. That will take you to the consumer portal directly.
See, or, Dan O'Minion just linked to that, to ingbu.com/PVM. Okay, and you're going to say one other way?
No, I was going to say, or you can you can go to one of our, you know, 100 or so partners like Technorati or Dragon Blogger is a blog that's using us. Deals of America is another site they use to connect the search to track deals. Okay. You know, so those are the ways to explore it.
Or they could meet you at a conference and corner you there and talk to you about the software and the website.
Yes, yes. But we're cheap. We don't have a booth.
Look for the guy who's running around trying to corner other people and corner him. I'll be looking for you in Sweden where we'll get to celebrate in the Swedish way. That sounds like a lot of fun. I like to get hammered. And finally, thank you, seriously. Thank you for doing this interview and sharing
Andrew.
What you've been up to.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Really
thank you guys all for watching. Tell me what you thought of this interview. Did I get you information you can go out there and use? Or whatever. In fact, come back and tell me that. Give me any other feedback. And finally, here's what else I'd like to hear via email. Anyone who's watching this, send me an email and tell me what you're working on right now. I want to find out. All right. Thank you. I'll see you on the website.